I was actually shocked that you chose this topic, but it looked like only four people voted, right? I was totally convinced that once I gave an option of how the rabbis ruined Judaism, that there was no question that people would... But now I realize that people know that. They don't need to hear anything about that. So that's like almost like nothing really to add to that. So instead, what we're going to do is talk about personal autonomy in Jewish law in the 21st century. But first, we'll talk about previous centuries, because I don't know all that much about the 21st century yet. And certainly, I don't know what people are going to say. But I have some... suspicions. When we think about personal autonomy, and again, I think we should be very honest about this. This is one of the largest changes which is taking place in society historically, which means if you go 500 years ago and you would have had a topic, personal autonomy, I don't think people would have known what you were talking about. Just as a general intellectual endeavor, personal autonomy, I just don't think it meant all that much. On the other hand, in the 20th century, it's become something which was incredibly important. And in the 21st century, which we've just really begun, it's something which is a given. I mean, of course, we have the right to make all kinds of decisions. So what I want to do is I want to actually compare and contrast a couple of Shelot and Tshuvot. I really have three separate topics. For those of you who went through all the sources, you would have seen that. There are really three topics which are separate, which are actually interrelated one way or the other. And before I started those topics, there was just a couple of things which were really a preliminary. And I'm going to preface it like this. Forget about religious Jews right now. And let's focus on America, even though I've been here probably longer than most of you. I've been here the last 31 years and 34 of the last 37 years, which is why I suspect I've been here a little longer than most of you. In America today, those who are pro-abortion, pro-choice, they would say, my body, my baby, my choice. And again, it's a given. As a rabbi, I was approached not that long ago with a question, which was a question regarding an abortion. And along the way I asked, I don't know if anyone will think this is an appropriate question or not, I asked, what does the father think? This was a single young woman. She was on 17. I asked, what does the father think? Did anybody think that's a relevant question or no? Well, by the way, it was at that point that she gave me the important information of saying, oh, I never want to see him again anyway, and he's in prison and he actually raped me. Oh, that may have been an important part of the question too, of taken into consideration, which, by the way, this happens all the time, that the most difficult thing as a rabbi before giving answers is trying to figure out what the right question was. Because inevitably, people asking you the questions have not been trained to ask questions, and they just ask questions which I think is the important question. So, let's go back. Issues about abortion, that's something which comes up in terms of personal autonomy. What's interesting to me, and maybe if you notice the Tshuvot that I quoted, is that most times when rabbis discuss this, they will give you a particular position. I'm not going to only give you that position, because I do want you to see that there's far more debate than people normally realize. Whether the debate is involved within personal autonomy or not, that's also something that I want to see. The first situation that we're dealing with is the question of cosmetic surgery. And finally from there, so cosmetic surgery, abortion, and then moving on to sex change operation. So therefore, those are like the easy topics. And of course, I hope you realize it's very challenging to do all three of those topics thoroughly within the time that we have. Yes? Yes. The Rambam writes, in this first source, Hilchot Chovel Umazik, Asur la'adam l'chvol bein ba'atzmo bein b'chavero, v'lo ha'chovel bilvad, ela kol ha'makeh adam kasher mi'Yisrael bein katan bein gadol bein ish bein isha, derech nitzayon, hareza over b'lo ta'aseh. So the Rambam over here sets up a law. The law is one is not allowed to hit anybody. If you hit somebody, you are breaking a Torah law. If you hit somebody, you may be obligated in terms of all kinds of rules which you'll find in the Chumash and find, in terms of payments, knasim and so on, which are found within the Chumash and later on in the Mishnah and the Gemara. And it sounds pretty black and white. Of course, there's one word in this whole sentence which makes it far more intriguing. Which word is that? derech nitzayon. If anybody fights, and what does the word nitzayon mean? We are familiar with that word, yes? Yes, so what does the word mean? Yeah, which means somebody does this, let's call this out of anger, out of a quarrel. I gave a class yesterday, which is anybody's learning Daf Yomi, it's tomorrow's Daf and get in Daf Lamed Vav. And that's a trick, by the way, to be a couple days ahead always. And there it speaks about, the topic in Gittin was about making a neder, and it says, well, what if they made a neder regarding a particular teacher who beat the kids, according to Rashi, not in Gittin, Rashi, in Bechorot, he actually killed them, and they made a neder, public neder, never to have this person as a teacher again, but then they realized there was nobody better, so they wanted to bring him back. And you know what's interesting? Not one of the Rishonim asks a moral question about that. Nobody raises a moral question. Hold it a second. Did you say that he killed somebody along the way? Didn't come up. Everybody just discussed the laws of neder. Is this a problem? One of the things that I got to, and by the way, I do believe that if a teacher hits a child or a teenager or an adult, they should be put in prison. I don't want this to be misinterpreted in any possible way. But if there is some kind of way that it's allowed, it can only, and by the way, this goes for parents as well, what I'm going to say. It's only possibly allowed, according to this Rambam, if it's done not out of anger. Even a parent. What divine right does a parent have to hit a child? So I'll say it again. When the Rambam says over here, you're not allowed to hit anybody, the only way that you can hit them is when it's out of a fight, out of a quarrel, out of anger. If there's no anger involved in it, it would be the only possibility we can even speak about it. A number of years ago, there is a fellow whose name is Yuri Foreman, who at one point was the world boxing champion. I don't know which weight. Middleweight, maybe. I don't know what. I'm sorry if I don't know what weight. But I did give a lecture. This probably goes back around 8 years ago. I gave a lecture in New York, and Yuri Foreman shows up to the lecture. And he has one of my books, and he asks me if I can sign the book for him. And we later on became friendly, and he actually once sent me tickets to one of his fights, which was like the worst thing you could possibly imagine, to see somebody get beat up, and somebody who you actually feel close to. And it's just a terrible thing. But I once did give a class in terms of the permissibility of being a boxer. With him, it was easy because he was actually beaten up by a Puerto Rican in New York, which I guess is not so special, except he made a lot of money. But if it would be allowed, it would only be allowed if on both sides there's no anger involved in it. If there's anger involved in it, it makes a problem. If the other, as I said, the other person's not Jewish, and that's just a whole other thing, because you may have also noticed that the Rambam said along the way, Adam Kasher Mi'Israel. So that creates one problem. So I'll say it again. A parent can't hit a child out of anger. Rabbi Soloveitchik once told us something, which any psychologist in the world would be incredibly disturbed when they hear this. You ready? That once he did something wrong, I don't know what it was, I don't know how horrific it was, but his father didn't do anything. And the next day, his father comes over and smacks him. He goes, what's that for? He goes, that's what you did yesterday. He goes, why are you hitting me today? He goes, yesterday I was mad. So he said, like, as I said, anybody, by the way, this is a father who never hugged his child, right? But he hit him. But not when he was mad. Only when he felt love towards him and affection towards him, then he hit him. Because there's a Reb Chaim about this, who makes a Chakira regarding this Rambam. You can find it in Gemara Ksuva, Daf Lamed Bet, in the stencil, where Reb Chaim speaks about, if it's not derech nitzayon, then there's no isser at all, or there's an isser, but there's no onesh, and you can start looking at the Chakira and figure out the Nafka Minute according to the Rambam. Is anybody with me so far? So
the
So now the question could come up, if are you mochel? Right? By the way, you want to demonstrate? You can come here. You can demonstrate and say, I'm mochel. So now the question would come up, am I allowed to hit you if you're mochel? So the Rambam doesn't deal with the question of mochel. What did the Rambam deal with? That the only way I could possibly hit somebody, if it's not out of anger. Why do you hit me? Because I'm not angry with you. Right? Because it's not part of a fight. By the way, there may very well be a different girsa in the Rambam. If you look in this smug, in source number 2, those of you who don't know, the Rambam is the Rambam from Spain, and then right lives in Egypt, and he writes the book in Egypt. One of the major impacts of the Rambam's writing was that he took the Gemara, and remember something, the Rambam most likely did not have Rashi growing up. Never quotes Rashi at all. most likely doesn't. There's a letter where the Rambam may have written it and may have told his son to use Rashi on the Chumash. We don't know if that's authentic or not. But the Rambam himself never quotes Rashi, seems to be completely unaware. He knows the Balei HaTosfot, by the way, but he does not know Rashi, at least never deals with Rashi. The Rambam translated all of the Gemara into simple Hebrew. I mean, again, we don't realize that sometimes, but you want to learn Bekiut? It's far easier to read the Rambam than it is to read a Gemara. The Rambam went and took every single phrase, I'm exaggerating a little bit, and he turns it into Hebrew. What did the Smag do? The Smag took all the Rambam's Hebrew, but took all the Psak Halacha of the Balei HaTosfot, and sort of made some kind of a hybrid, but the Smag is coming from the area of Tosfot. He, again, has the Rambam word for word, except for maybe one word. Asur l'adam l'chol ben ba'atzoe mechavero. That tetvav is just a note there. V'lo ha'chov u'bavad el kol ha'makeh adam kasher mi'Yisrael ben katan ben gadol ben ish ben isha derech bizayon hareza over below taseh. So over here, there may be two. So the achronim who deal with this Rambam, some deal with it. When is it a prohibition? If it's derech bizayon, you're going to embarrass somebody. How do some of them understand it? Derech nitzayon, with fighting. So now the question, of course, is going to come up. So what happens if you hit somebody and it's not? Now, if it's not bizayon and not nitzayon, so now hold that a second, place that on the side. In the Shulchan Aruch, we have an interesting case, and also I had a case like, literally, I had this case a couple of weeks ago. Somebody who is a male nurse, he called me up, and his specialty is one particular area. His father has that particular thing that he deals with, and he said, can I go to my father's house and treat him, but he will bleed along the way when I treat him? Or need I take him to the hospital so somebody else can do it? But then I have to take him and schlep him, and he'll wait in the whole drive and then wait in the hospital and the whole experience in the hospital. Well, can I do it myself? So what's the answer? What's the psak? So let's read what the Shulchan Aruch says. Hayakotz tachuv la'aviv lo yatzi enu shema yavo lasot bo chavura v'chein imu makizdam o rofe lo yakizdam la'aviv lo yachtoch lo ever afal pisha machavin lefu'a. So we can put this in really as, let's call it the dentist question. You're a dentist, your father has a toothache, can you then take out the rotted tooth? Hagad, the Rama writes, v'medver murim b'sheyei sham acher la'asot, when there's somebody else there who can do it. Aval im ein sham acher la'asot, but there's no one else there who can do it, v'hu mitzta'er, and he's in pain, harei hu makiz v'chotech lo kefi ma'ashe yershuhu la'asot. You can do it if no one else is there. So, by the way, you agree with my psak or you disagree? No one else is there, but you have to put him in a car to bring him someplace else where someone else is there? How do you define someone else is there? So what are the words here? No one else is there. And what else did it say? Whom it's there. And to bring him someplace else, we'll call Morris Tsar. So what did I paskin? Yeah, you can go treat your father in his house. And he's going to bleed. Don't worry. The Rama says black and white that this is okay. Now, why is it okay? Makeh aviv imo mot yumat. Why is this okay? So define makeh, but you're causing him to bleed, mot yumat. How in the world can I, or the Rama, paskin against the law and the Torah? So now you have to say, how does the Rama therefore understand the law?
You understand the Rama. Understand the Rama was saying that...
Correct. So it has to be that this is not called makeh, which means don't get fooled that just because he's bleeding doesn't mean that you hit him. Why? Because this is done out of love and out of respect and out of care, and not done out of anger or, right, anger or
malice,
embarrassment, which means the fact that now we see is that this is paskin in the Shulchan Aruch, so that also should be interesting. Source number 4 is probably incredibly important in terms of the whole issue of autonomy. As I said, 21st century, I don't know, but if we go back to the 19th century, we have something interesting. V'nira l'ania da'ati, d'ze shachai v'atorah b'maka aviv v'imo b'chavero, haynu dafke b'lo reshut. Now he just now, meaning he did not use the words bizayon o nitzayon. Again, according to the Rambam, and certainly the way that Rav Chaim wants to learn the Rambam, if I hit somebody, but it's out of love, right, you know, there's a rattlesnake on your father's back, and you take a 2x4 and you hit the rattlesnake. Sorry. Would that be breaking a Torah law according to the Rav? Of course, no, it's not done out of anger. But over here, it just went a little bit further. Because the Minchat Chinuch is not talking about, by definition, this isn't hitting. He's talking about something which is hitting. But do I have the right? Do I have the right to say, it's my body, right? Go ahead. My body, my baby, right? It's my body, and I'm giving you permission. Because what could I have argued that in terms of Jewish law, it's not my body? So the Minchat Chinuch comes, and we'll have to try to evaluate whether he actually has evidence for this. Skipping a little bit of the in chayv malkut or mita, which you skip a lot. The very end, aval im aviv mochel umitzavel lahakoto nira deinu chayv klal v'chein b'chaveru ve'inu over klal ve'afapi shalom matzati zem furash mikol makom hasvara notenet ken. Barur. He says, I'm sure of this, even though I really don't have any evidence for this. But again, do you see the difference between what he says versus what we saw in the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam? According to Minchat Chinuch, your father wants to go boxing with you. Are you allowed to box? Why? But you're not, again, I'm going to say it again, but you're not allowed to hit him. So according to the Rambam, according to Minchat Chinuch, you're allowed to be mochel. By the way, if I say things that you need to know, I need to translate, please tell me. I'm just assuming that we understand. You're allowed to be mochel, so therefore, it's not that there's no isur, it's not that there's no prohibition, but he's mochel, so therefore he's mochel, it's okay. So this, in terms of the issue of personal autonomy, this minchat chinuch is huge. But what's the weakness of what he says? What's the weakness of what he says? He admits that he has no proof for it. Okay. Shulchan Aruch Harav, this is the Baal HaTanya. He has the exact opposite perspective of the Minchat Chinuch. So therefore, anybody ever asks you, that's the machloket, Minchat Chinuch on the one hand, and the Shulchan Aruch Harav on the other. Asur lahakot et chaverero, afilu hu noten lo rishut lakoto, ke'en l'adam rishut al gufo klal lakoto, o levaisho, v'lo letzaro, bishum tzar. So what position does he take? Doesn't make a difference. You cannot tell somebody else my body. So it sounds to be that the question of autonomy would really break down to this argument between the Minchat Chinuch versus the Shulchan Aruch Harav. Shulchan Aruch Harav say you have no authority, rights over your body to make certain decisions. And again, we are testing this with one very narrow question, hitting or not hitting, whereby we find that what would have been considered to be makah, according to the Shulchan Aruch, we find the Rama at least saying, I could heal my father even though he may bleed. That's not considered hitting. We find the Rambam saying that if my father or anybody else, it's not out of anger, it's not out of malice, it's something which is done because they let you do it for whatever reason, but there's no anger. Two kids are wrestling, even hitting one another. Rambam would say it's allowed. Shulchan Aruch Harav, however, would say, you can't hit somebody. Somebody says, go, hit me, give me your best. Shulchan Aruch Harav would say, you have no right to. It's not his body, you have no right to. Minchat Chinuch would say, you could, yeah.
Shulchan Aruch Harav means you can't be a doctor at all.
You can't?
You can't be a doctor at all.
I don't know what you can do. I don't know. Yes.
What are our basic things here that were stuff that we started with?
That's your homework. We'll take a look at the Lopsukim. By the way, if you noticed, which you did, I skipped the Psukim, and I skipped the Gemaras, and I don't care. And what I wanted to do instead is really to start with the Rambam, and we'll see if we can go backwards a little bit. Now, anybody read the next three Tshuvot? Anybody notice anything interesting about the next three Tshuvot? They were all asked by the same person. He went around, I don't know, shopping, I don't know. He went and he asked the same question to three different people. Rav Moshe Feinstein does not tell you who asked the question, but in source number 6 at the end of the first line it says, it's dated Kaf Adar Tavshin Kaf Dalid. I don't believe he writes it, no. If you look at the next source, the Chelkot Yaakov of Mordechai Yaakov Breish, he died in 1976, he was considered to be a major posek. He tells us at the very end of the Tshuva, which is the top of page 3, it was in Tzirich Gimel Teve Tavshin Kaf Dalid. The next Tshuva of Menashe Klein is written Chet Lahadlakat, right? The eighth cant of Hanukkah. Which date would that be? Sorry, put you on the spot. That would be Bet Tevet. So you have literally Gimel Tevet, Bet Tevet. Now the only question is with Rav Moshe, because I can assure you it's the same question. So the other question is, did it sit on Rav Moshe's desk for 3 months before he got to it, or did he write to Rav Moshe afterwards? Here's the question. It was asked by a Hasidic Rebbe, who was a grandson of the Tzanzer Rebbe, the Devar Chaim Mitzanz. The question is, there's somebody, and sometimes you have to be careful when somebody has a question about somebody. He talks about a young woman who is of marriageable age, who, according to the various descriptions over here, has a nose which is in need of a rhinoplasty, at least in the opinion, the learned opinion of the Hasidic Rebbe over here. Now, whether he's actually the father or not, we don't know. I can tell you that there's a tshuva that there's a Rabbi Goldberg from New Orleans writes a question to Rav Moshe. The question that he asks him is a person allowed to be an actor on Shabbos where somebody else will put the makeup on him and then he'll go and perform? Is this allowed? So Rav Moshe then writes back, says, this is a ridiculous question. What kind of livelihood is this for a Jewish kid? What are you talking about? And practically saying, if this was my son, I would never let him do it, but he doesn't actually say that. And he goes on and on and says, but if push comes to shove, if it's a non-Jew putting makeup on you, then there's no Isser involved. You can keep that in mind. And I happen to know who he wrote the tshuva to. It was this Rabbi Goldberg's son, who is today, for the last 50 years or so, has been living in Kibbutz Tirat Zvi, Kaddish Goldberg. Hope I'm not getting in trouble by saying this, but his father wrote the tshuva to Rav Moshe asking to my son, but he never used the word son in it. So Rav Moshe never responded to the son because he never dreamed that it was actually his son. This is one of, I think, six or seven tshuvot you can find in the Igret Moshe written to this rabbi in New Orleans. If you're ever interested, for whatever bizarre reason, in knowing about the history of New Orleans, don't ask me why, I know this. Now, all of these people are asked the same question. Now, is there a question? And the most interesting line in all of this is the beginning of the tshuva from Rabbi Breish in source number 7, where he writes, Lefi mi'ut yediati lo matzati b'sifrei ha'tshuvot misha diber b'zeh. He says, as far as I know, I never heard anybody asking the question. What's the question? Can you do cosmetic surgery? Now, by the way, in our world today, would anybody see this as a question even? In 21st century Judaism, is anybody asking this question? Nobody's asking this anymore. But in 1964, when plastic surgery or cosmetic surgery first becomes a possibility, the question is asked, again, coming out of Borough Park, right? Kimi Borough Park, Teitzei Torah, right? Dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. It goes out from Borough Park and he asks a bunch of different people. I don't know if he had his own approach and was asking them what they think about it or whatever, but as I said, they asked different people. Rav Moshe's tshuva is interesting. It's concise. I'll tell you what he says, even though he never says it. What Rav Moshe says is, in order for me to tell you why, the first thing you need to figure out why it's not allowed. Okay, let's go the other way around, Rav Moshe says. What could possibly be the prohibition? If there's no prohibition, then by default, it's allowed. Should I say that again? If there's no prohibition, by default, it's allowed. Doesn't get involved in anything which we would call today meta-halachic considerations, social considerations, anything else. What does Moshe say? Is there a prohibition? Now, should I help you guessing what Rav Moshe is going to say? I'll give you a hint. Rav Moshe knew the Rambam just as well as we knew the Rambam. So what's his answer going to be? When can't you hit somebody or cause somebody some kind of pain? You can't do it if it's done out of anger. What if you're the doctor and you're about to make a bunch of money on this? Is this out of anger? Absolutely not. Right? What if you're the doctor who's about to make a lot of money and you think you're doing somebody a favor because you're going to make them beautiful? Is there any kind of isser over here? So if Moshe basically says, what's the isser? What's the isser? And what's interesting is he goes to the Rambam. Why does he go to the Rambam and not to the Gemara and not to the Pasuk like he wanted to? Because the Rambam defines the isser. By the Rambam throwing in, Derech Bizayon is the problem. And what's he going to say here? This is not only, can you say it? Not only is this not Derech Bizayon, but what would you say? It's in order to prevent what she feels is the Bizayon that she's experiencing right now. So therefore, for Rav Moshe, this is going to be a no-brainer. I'll read it through quickly, source number 6. Nishalti ben Narashu Atzeli Afot Atzma Kadesh Yikfitsu Ale Lekadsha al yedei mashi himtziu ata harofim al yedei nituach shehu chabala bigufa. So he just now analyzed it. When you do surgery to somebody, what do? To them? You do a chabala. You take a knife and you cut them. If you walk down the street, you take a knife and you cut them. That's not a good thing. So if Moshe is saying you're doing chabala, is this not allowed either because you can't hurt yourself or because you can't hurt somebody else? By the way, what would the Shulchan Aruch Rav say about this? According to the Shulchan Aruch Rav, this is not a very simple issue. Aval haRambam hu katav b'rosh perakei michovu b'Yisrael ka'al adam kasham Yisrael shehu makeh derech nitzayon ulechad girsa derech bizayon. Right? The Rambam says the prohibition is when you do it out of anger, out of malice, out of trying to embarrass. This is not the case over here. So what's Rav Moshe going to say? Mutar. And that's the tshuva. That's the whole thing. He throws something else in at the end he throws in a Gemara at the end also, just that no one should think that Rav Moshe doesn't know the Gemara. But really that's what his whole heter is based on. The Imkain ben Arai liyafot atzma shehula tovata uveritzona yesh latir bipshitut. He says there's no question about this. This is allowed. You're making her look better. She wants this, so therefore it's allowed. But again, what does Moshe not bring up into this whole discussion? He never brought up issues of autonomy. Issues of personal autonomy are a non-issue for him. Why are they not an issue for him? Because he wrote this in 1964. What's Rav Moshe's question? Allowed, not allowed. What does Moshe not care about? He doesn't care about the meta-halacha considerations which some of us may start to bring up. Doesn't make a difference. This is allowed. Why is it allowed? As I said, real simple, real basic logic. Because there's no prohibition, so it's allowed. Rav Breish comes to the same conclusion, but he comes through it a different way. What does he do? He brings the source in the Shulchan Aruch that I showed you. That you're not allowed to hit your father, but if you're helping him by causing him to bleed, you're allowed to do it. So if it's allowed by a father, then what now can you say? Kal v'chomer, you can do it for somebody else. So therefore, by the way, this itself is very interesting. Where Rav Moshe goes for the basic definition, by the way, Rav Moshe more often than not will start off in the Gemara. Because he's looking for the basic sugi. He wants to understand the basic issue. Other poskim, their starting point will be the Shulchan Aruch. What does the Shulchan Aruch have to say? So that's a question of the personal approach of the posek, but over here, both of them come independently. They don't know about the other one, right? You know the famous Gemara and Megillah that says they took 70 rabbis and put them into 70 different rooms and they asked them to translate the Chumash, and they all came to the exact same thing. With Rav Huttner once said that the bigger nace would have put them all in the same room to see if they can come up to the same same conclusion. That would be a far bigger miracle if you know rabbis. But over here, you took Rav Moshe, put him in one room, and then you put Rav Breish, put him in another room. They come to the same conclusion, even though they take different paths. The third rabbi who was approached on this is Rav Menashe Klein. Do you know who Rav Menashe Klein is? Rav Menashe Klein, who I met. Menashe Klein, this is in verse number 8. He was the Rav of Ungvar. He went through the Holocaust with Elie Wiesel. They were together. You remember, anybody Yerushalayim, Ramat Poland, in the middle of Ramot, the place that looks like a soccer ball inverted, whatever? There's a Beis Medrash of Menashe Klein there, and that's where he used to live at least half the year. Other half the year he was in Borough Park. And Rav Menashe Klein's Beis Medrash is dedicated by Elie Wiesel in memory of his parents. And they used to learn B'Chavrusa, which itself is pretty interesting, because his other Chavrusa during the same time was Professor Saul Lieberman. Those are the people that Elie Wiesel used to learn with. One representing the more modern approach to learning, the other back to literally the shtetl and how we used to learn as a kid. And these were his two friends. This is, again, something which I find interesting. Menashe Klein, in many areas, is I don't want this to come off really wrong, but I want you to understand him. Rav Menashe Klein, in many, many areas, is disturbing as a posek. When I say he's disturbing, he's the posek who, if you ask him a question, I shouldn't say this before finals, are you allowed to cheat? Of course you're allowed to cheat. I mean, why shouldn't you be allowed to cheat? The government, the goyim, who cares what the goyim think and so on? Unless maybe because of cheating, maybe you really don't have the credentials and then you'd be over gzela when you claim that you're a doctor but you cheated your way through medical school. So that could be a problem with gzela, which means, there's a certain aspect of, Rav Menashe Klein would say, you can't eat Chinese food, because it's b'chuk oseim lo selechu. And by the way, I'm not kidding. These are examples of tshuvot that he has. I can give you a whole list of tshuvot. That, on the other hand, Rav Menashe Klein was the one who allowed, anybody here from Brooklyn? Nobody from Brooklyn, here from Brooklyn? He's the one who allowed that the Erev in Brooklyn when Rav Moshe Feinstein said you can't have an Erev in Brooklyn. Why? Because in Europe we used to have Erev, so why can't we have an Erev in Brooklyn? And he allowed the Erev, he went against Rav Moshe on this. So Rav Menashe Klein sometimes is very, very, very unexpected what he's going to say. In this particular case, he goes back to a Mishnah. The Mishnah says if there's a Kohen who has an extra finger and therefore is possible from doing avoda in the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen can cut off the finger to be able to become, have to take away the mum. Don't think about that too long. I see you making a face there, and after eating cholent, I'm a little scared here. So he says you can cut off the finger to take away the mum. So he says it's a beferish Mishnah. You can cut off a finger to take a mum. You can cut something off, take a mum. You can cut her nose off and make it half the size that it was before, and this is perfectly okay. And there, and again, the three of them give the tshuvot. The three of them allow it, no question whatsoever. Now, there's a fourth posek who was not asked. Right. So obviously he's the one that I want to talk about. So the one who wasn't asked was the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg. And Rabbi Waldenberg is the only one of these four who gets involved in what we can call meta-halachic considerations. It's in source number 12 at the very end. At one point I thought that would be how I would end, but I decided to end it differently. Tzitz Eliezer was, as far as I know, Jerusalem born. I was at a bar mitzvah yesterday, which was his great-great nephew, was the bar mitzvah. So I gave a shiur in the afternoon all about the Tzitz Eliezer. Tzitz Eliezer was born in Yerushalayim, but I did find one thing out, that his father was an illegal here at one point. During World War I, different sides came in, and he had to run away. So they ran away to Halab, to Syria. So the Tzitz Eliezer grew up in Chalab for a couple of years, came back. Rav Herzog was a great judge of talent, right? Rav Kook dies in 1935. Rav Herzog becomes the chief rabbi. He collected a Friday morning chabura of guys who he would come and let's discuss learning. So you know who he had in this chabura? Rav Elyashiv, Rav Vosner, Rav Ovadia, Rav Waldenberg, and the list goes on and on. He found every young and up-and-coming Talmud Chacham Yerushalayim, and he says, come, let's learn together. He made them all Dayanim. He was the one who mentored them all. All the people I just said were mentored by Rav Herzog. Okay. Later on, he sits in the same hair cave in the Beit Din HaGadol with Rav Ovadia. The two of them are incredibly friendly. When they have tshuvot back and forth to one another, Rav Ovadia calls Rav Waldenberg Rab Achai Gaon, right? My brother the Gaon. That's what he calls him. What else can I tell you about him? If you want to write an article on anything in Jewish in halacha, all you need to do is to find the same topic that Rav Ovadia wrote about and Rav Waldenberg wrote about. The two of them, on the average, write tshuvot around 15 pages long, bringing every single source you can imagine and many, many, many that you couldn't imagine. And I can guarantee you that the libraries are full of articles of people doing exactly that. They just use their scholarship and then they write their own, you know, things at the end. You may believe they found all those things. If they're clever, they'll quote the sources in a different order. But between the Tzitz Eliezer of Oldenburg and Mutun of Avadia, you basically have everything that you can imagine covered. Okay, the other thing you should know about him is that he was the official posek of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, which is why this is far more interesting. When it came down to cosmetic surgery, he said, absolutely not. It's not allowed. Who can ever allow such a thing? But what's most interesting is that he gives meta-halacha considerations. This is all in source number 12. He's bothered about the cost-risk-benefit in terms of anesthesia. Who gave you permission to put yourself out? You may not wake up. If you're in a life and death situation, of course you can do it. But if you're not in a life situation, simply because you want to look better, who can allow such a thing? The She'ein b'kol hashavet shel aveda. He goes, why are you allowed to do medicine? The Ramban writes that medicine is hashavet aveda. I don't know if you ever knew that. Right? Medicine, right? Refu'ah min ha-Torah minayin. So you would say, you're a peh. So that's the reshut. Mikan reshut the rofei lerpot. But how do you know that there's a mitzvah? So the Ramban says it's hashavet aveda. You have a mitzvah to return somebody their health to them. So he says, the mitzvah of health is only returning it. He goes, but that's only if you're returning something. By the way, there's a huge, huge argument you can make on this. If somebody was born, of course, somebody's born with a deformity, you say, oh no, you're not returning, you can't do it. But that's the line that he chooses to go. And if that's not good enough, then guess what he pulls out? You know when this is coming, you're in trouble towards the middle of the page. And he goes, on the other hand, Sheker Hachain, the Hevel Hayofi. Isha Yiret Hashem, Hitit Halal. I mean, what's your problem? So essentially, right, so do I need to go any further? Or you already know which way the winds are blowing over here? But now again, I have to ask, is this really halacha consideration? Or do we just find the meta halacha consideration? And is the meta halacha consideration, is it one anti-personal autonomy? Or is this independent of personal autonomy and because of other kinds of considerations? And that I'm leaving open because I can't read his mind. But what I can do, and that what I want to do, is keeping this in mind, is to see two other tshuvot of Rav Oldenburg, and then we'll see how they all perhaps fit together or how they don't fit together, and then you'll decide for yourselves if he's consistent. And if he is consistent, what is his approach? And if he's not consistent, then what do we conclude then? Okay. Now we can go to abortion. For Moshe Feinstein, abortion was a very simple discussion. What was it? Not allowed. What is it? It's murder. Abortion is murder. That's it. By the way, Rav Moshe does admit, and this is interesting, he does admit that living in America, in a society which is so permissive, he says we need to be a little stricter than we would be otherwise, right? So you just now heard it. That's a meta halachic consideration. We need to even more strict. But even without this, Rav Moshe will tell you that an abortion is murder. Therefore, what is going to be the only situation when it's possibly allowed? If the mother's life is in danger. And the only reason it's allowed, because there's a Mishnah that says it. If the mother's life is in danger, then you can kill the fetus to save the mother. That's the only situation. Otherwise, absolutely no heter. Tay-Sachs baby, which is the case that Rav Moshe deals with. A Tay-Sachs baby. Now, Tay-Sachs is a terrible disease. Tay-Sachs is a disease. The kid is going to have a short, painful life. Rav Moshe said, a Tay-Sachs baby, you cannot do anything. I have a friend who had a Tay-Sachs baby, and the baby died. And when the baby was diagnosed, she was pregnant, and she wanted to go and have testing to see. There's a 1 in 4 chance. 25% chance the baby she's carrying has. And after going through, I don't have to explain to you all the emotional hell that they were going through, that had they known that the second one was Tay-Sachs as well, they would have wanted to have an abortion. Rav Moshe says in such a case, absolutely not. You have no right to kill a baby. You can only kill a fetus to save the mother's life. There's no other situation where it's possible to even imagine such a thing. If you want to see this, we'll take a look at Rav Moshe in source number 9 on page 4. Rav Yaakov Emdin tried to argue in certain cases where we could be lenient. His case was, what if a woman who's married cheated on her husband and is now carrying a baby who is illegitimate, but more importantly, that had we lived during the time of the Sanhedrin, she would have been put to death for that sin that she did. So then maybe this baby also deserves to be put to death, so maybe she can have an abortion to kill the baby that should be put to death. So Rav Yaakov Emdin writes this. And Rav Moshe says, are you out of your mind? That's what he says. Are you out of your mind? If you want to read it, V'nei b'she'elot Ya'avetz. Ya'avetz is Yaakov Emdin, Yaakov ben Tzvi, Yaakov the son of the Chacham Tzvi. Simon Memgimor, iti dvarim shalonit nule hamer. I saw things written that a person's not allowed to say even. Sheba ubar mamzer, matir lahapilo, mitam sheisha bizman shemisan hedim, lishkar agazit, hayum achayvin ota mitav, velo imam titin ad she yoled mikra, digam shneem, nechshav havlad kibar katala, umutar gam mitzvah lahapilo. And therefore, Yaakov Emdin comes to the conclusion, a woman is carrying an illegitimate child, mitzvah to do an abortion and to kill her. And Rav Moshe says, are you out of your mind? He says, I can't even believe, Rav Moshe says, I can't even believe such a thing and ignore this. And then he goes on to say, also there's a Chavat Yair, which is, okay, I'm going to tell you a secret. Here's a secret. The Gemara doesn't talk about every single case. Even though the Mishnah and the Gemara tell us that if a woman is in danger, you're allowed to do an abortion, the Gemara never says if you're allowed to do an abortion because you want to do an abortion. There's no such Gemara. Did you hear what I said? There's no Gemara that discusses if you do an abortion, what the punishment is, and if you broke a law. There's no such Gemara. Now, maybe that's important, maybe it's not important. Do you know what also there's no Gemara? There's no Gemara that says you're not allowed to commit suicide. No Gemara. Doesn't say. Now, it could be it's not important. Because what does it say in the Chumash? You want to go back to the Torah. What does it say in the Chumash? Lo tirtzach. So what's the problem? What's the definition of tirtzach? What's suicide? I'm taking a life. Maybe that's ritzicha. Just because I put a fancy name. What about fratricide? You allowed to do fratricide? It doesn't say any place in the Gemara you can't do fratricide. Chumash says you shouldn't do it. Ochi and ochi. What about mother-in-law? What about, even better, sister-in-law aside? Right? Are you allowed to kill your sister-in-law? It never says you can't kill your sister-in-law. She's not going to hear this, right? No. Are you allowed to kill your sister-in-law? Never says, no, it's murder, it's retzach, you can't do it. So Rav Moshe would argue, killing a fetus is retzach. There's nothing to talk about, it's murder. The fact that there's a fancy name for it, that we call it abortion, ma'achpatli, still taking a life. But the fact that Gemara never discusses it is still nonetheless interesting, because I can still argue that perhaps a potential life is not the same thing as a life. The other person who he quoted along the way was the Chavat Yair, who says, well, maybe an abortion is no different from birth control. Maybe it's not murder. Maybe it's only drabanan. So that's the Chavat Yair, which Rav Moshe obviously is not going to love either. And shall we skip a little bit? And now we'll read the second paragraph on source 9 on page 4. Katavti kozeh le'inyin hafratza hagdola ba'olam shehamalchiyot harbei medinot hitiru laharog ubarim uvutocham gam roshei hamedinot b'medina Yisrael v'kfar nehergu ubarim le'in mispar shebizman hazeh ha'od yesh tzorech lasot siag l'torah. Anybody notice that meta-halachic argument just now? He goes, in our time, we have to be even more. He goes, the Chacham Tzvi's being Menkel, we have to be more machmir in this time. V'kolshken shelo la'asot kulot be'isser ritzicha achamor biyoter. Certainly when something which is murder, and I'll say it again, Rav Moshe really believes that it's murder. Which, by the way, doesn't mean that he ever didn't perhaps allow it in a passive way, but I won't reveal everything right now, but my father, who was a rabbi, did once have a case where an abortion would take place unless you do something, and my father, and he told my, oh, no, don't do anything. Let them do whatever they're going to do. Don't get involved. But still, he didn't go screaming, it's murder, told them they can't do it. It was a case where he let them go, okay, just stand on the side and let whatever happens, happens. But still, now, we'll read the next part. Shelechei nishtomamti b'roti tshuva michacham echad be'eretz Yisrael ha'nichtav l'menahel beit ha'cholim sharei tzedek v'nitfas b'choveret asya yud gimel. By the way, notice, he won't even say his name. So who is the person that Rav Moshe will not name, but he told you exactly where to look it up? And who is writing to the heads of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital to tell them what they can do, what they can't do? What's the answer? It's the Tetzel Yezer, it's Rav Waldenberg. So he says, I can't believe that he wrote, now you go a little bit further, Hamatir holadat sha'idei b'chinat ha'rofim kishu ubar yoter mi gimel chodoshim shivar huma b'machla tesax la pilo. That Rav Waldenberg's allowing a tesax abortion into the third month. Mitzadzei ekdim sha'etz and not only that, Rav Waldenberg's claiming that according to some people, it's not even a draita. I know a case personally that there was a couple who had a baby with severe, severe deformities, and they went to Rav Waldenberg, and Rav Waldenberg allowed them to an abortion in the seventh month. Not the first month, not the first prime minister, in the seventh month. And Rav Moshe is going crazy on that, and he won't even quote him by name. Okay, if you look at, and the Tzitz Eliezer has a huge amount on this, and you look at source number 10. So I'll explain to you his background. There's a Gemara in Eirchin that says that if a woman's about to be executed, a woman is about to be executed, she broke whatever law she broke, witnesses, court, she's about to be executed. What if she's about to be executed and she's pregnant? So the Mishnah says, what do you do? Well, the Gemara says it clearly, what do you do? It says you kill the baby first so that she not be humiliated to spontaneously go into labor while she's being executed, because she was sentenced to death and she wasn't sentenced to humiliation, and we are very, very concerned about people's feelings. So when we kill them, we want to make sure they don't go into labor. Yes, you like that. Okay. A number of Sephardic poskim said, hold it a second. Let me do the math now. So to avoid humiliation, I'm allowed to do an abortion? And then they use this in real cases. So what if a teenage girl got pregnant, and if anybody finds out of it, that she'll be humiliated, could hurt her shidduch chances, even if her nose is normal size? Fine, do an abortion. You all appreciate Rav Moshe would say, what are you talking about? And he's screaming that Rav Oldenburg quoted these poskim, although I can assure you that there's more people who quoted these poskim than you possibly can imagine. Anybody surprised right now or no? No, you're not even surprised? Can't surprise you? Fine, we'll get better then. And the Tzitz Eliezer quotes regarding an eshet isha zintav in itab rabiznot, muteret l'shtot devar shetap'il ha'ubar. So there, the Rav Pe'ilim was asked this. So he, what did he say? What was his answer? Look in the Maharit, who allowed it in the case I just now told you. Look in Rav Yaakov Emden, and look in the Chavat Yair, and then pask in any way that you think is appropriate. By basically telling him to look in those sources, what was he telling him? That it's okay. But he goes, I'm not going to tell you what to do. You decide what you want to do. So that's what the Tzitzel is quoting over here. And he writes where it's underlined again, that's considered to be a good enough reason to do an abortion. Now, do you realize what's interesting here? Rav Waldenberg is allowing an abortion. Rav Moshe thinks that it's murder. Rav Waldenberg will not allow you to have a nose job, but he'll let you have an abortion. One second. Is that interesting? Rav Moshe will let you have a nose job, but he won't let you have an abortion. Now, you all realize that these things are not necessarily interwoven or interrelated, but more than... Yeah, go ahead.
They clearly are. One comes from a metaphysics. Rav Moshe is just sitting down saying the halakha is X, the halakha is Y, so nose job to us because... No, sorry, the motive to wrong says murder. Murder is us, it's murder. It's not like... It's a surprise they come from the same... They're very much the shikasa.
That's the definition.
Maybe. So let's go to Rav Oldenburg. So Rav Oldenburg, is he dealing with personal autonomy? Not dealing with personal autonomy. When it comes to cosmetic surgery, he says absolutely not. It's God's body. Who gave you the right to right? Sheker achein vehevel yofi. Who gives you the right to such a thing? Again, and it was the most extreme position we saw. On the other hand, this girl's going to be embarrassed because she's pregnant? Fine, go ahead, do an abortion. I'm just saying, it's interesting to compare these two cases. And look, part of it may be that each one is an independent halacha, which exists in this independent orbit, and you really can't compare one to the other. And that's what I'm saying. Or maybe there's something more. Now, when it comes to the last case that I wanted to discuss, you can go online and you can Google transsexual surgery, Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenburg, and you're going to find people who will say things like, Waldenburg ruled that sex reassignment surgery for transsexuals affects a change in the person's halachic gender. Right? You're going to find people who say that Waldenburg claims that one who undergoes transsexual surgery, he never discussed it. He never discussed it, but that doesn't make a difference because everyone knows already, or you can even look at it as a Wikipedia article, unless one of you decides to edit it in the next 10 minutes. It quotes him as saying, yeah, you can have transsexual surgery. It's absolutely okay. Now, the only problem is that he never said it. He does have two tshuvot about transsexual surgery. Now, again, the kind of thing that I want you to keep in mind, this is the same guy who said you can't fix your nose. One second. What are the odds of him then saying, but sure, you can do all kinds of other things, by the way, a number of those things are absolutely cosmetic. And if you already told us you can't have cosmetic surgery, it sounds a little strange that he's going to be the one who says, sure, no problem whatsoever. So here is where we need to be careful. And again, if you already want me to give you the conclusion before we read this, I'll tell you the conclusion. The conclusion is that when we get to the 21st century, it doesn't make a difference what any rabbi ever says anymore. It all depends on what somebody writes on the internet about what he said. And whoever writes it on the internet, they're the one who wins, and people will just end up Googling anyway. It makes no difference whatsoever. And over here, everybody knows and everybody quotes that Rav Oldenburg says that transsexual surgery is allowed. It's just an absolute given. As I said, you can look up and see how many articles quote this as a given. So let's take a look and see what it is that he may say and what it is that he perhaps doesn't say. So it starts off on the bottom of page 4, source number 10. Sorry, that's the abortion one. Sorry, very bottom of source 11. Very bottom of page number 4. What is the topic he's talking about? By the way, is that sometimes relevant to what the topic is? Topic is fascinating. He's talking about somebody who's about to have a heart transplant and wants to know who's the guy who's going to wake up. Is it the guy whose heart you have, or is the old guy, which means does the heart define who you are, or does the heart not define who you are? And again, I'm going to say this. We're just so used to all kinds of medical procedures, including transplants, that this kind of question doesn't really concern us. But when he's raising this point, this is something which for him is very, very important. What is a human being? Is a human being a the neshama which is inside? Is the human being the various body parts? Is it the external? Is it what it looks like on the outside? Is it the parts? Is it the neshama? And you realize now that there's all kinds of possibilities what the human being is. That's what he's dealing with. Birir zehut v'yichus shel shetul lev, regarding the identity of an individual who undergoes a heart transplant. U'mechkar ashinuyim mahutiyim achirim, and regarding people who undergo other similar types of transformations. So you appreciate the existential question. So who am I? Am I, so by the way, honestly, are any of you really bothered by the question? Right? None of us are. What? Right. None of us are really bothered by this question. None of us are really bothered by the question, but it's interesting. Now, along the way, he brings up something which is crazy. And this is part of the reason we need to be very, very careful. In part, let me just see, Dalid, which is a little further down, Vishlishit, Zehutobi Chosor Shadam, Einon Mitpateh Benifrad B'Chalkei Evarav, V'Tiyenena HaChashuvim B'Yoter. A person's identity is not determined by the parts, no matter how important that part is. Ki'im Ela Ruach V'Neshama Shepirko, right? It's the Neshama. Any of you surprised that that's the conclusion? Of course not. I mean, we all knew that's what was coming. Okay. In number Vav, which is a little further down, and you realize we're skipping a bit here, U'mechkar gadol yesh amnam l'chkor b'hecha shemitcholel shinui mahuti. What's the next word?
Organi.
Do you think that's important in all this discussion? What he's about to discuss is a very specific, very strange medical condition where somebody thinks that they are one sex, let's say in this particular case, a female, and then at a later stage than normally would be understood, the person spontaneously becomes the other gender. Now, there are documented cases like this. Especially, please keep in mind that even though he's talking about somebody's wife, people got married at very, very early ages in the past. There's somebody who, as far as anybody can tell, was a woman, which means the male genitalia did not exist externally, it was internal within. It looked like he was, in fact, a woman, but later on, because of certain hormonal changes, suddenly he becomes very, very clearly a he. That's the case that he's dealing with. By the way, this is not transsexual surgery. This is a very specific medical condition that he's discussing, and you notice the word organi. There will be something else he says that you can argue back, say, no, he's talking, but let's read anyway. He says, Shinui ma'uti organi begufo shel adam, kimo benitapech mizachar l'nekeva. You just now heard him say it. O lehefech, וכפי ששמעתי וגם נתפסם עד כך בכתבי עת שונים, מבצעים כיום גם ניתוחים כאלה במקרים מיוחדים וכמובן נדירים. Now I'm going to say it again. He's not talking about transsexual surgery. What? He's talking about gender assignment where there is a lack of clarity regarding the development of this particular individual.
Also, the verb in itself is passive, which is presumably feminine.
I'll just tell you, once you said diktuk, I sort of like, don't listen anymore. Anyway, go ahead. It's passive? Correct. It's organi and it happened by itself. 100%. בשינוי מהותי כזה נוצרים באמת הרבה בעיות הנוגעות לקביעותו וייחודו האיש של אנוש כזה. אזכיר בזה מה שראיתי בספר זיכרון. And he says, I'm going to quote something which I've seen. And he quotes where it's from. בחדר גמלים מעט ומוצא לאור סף. Hey, בתוך עריכות דבר בסיכרי מקרים בעניין טומטום ואנדרוגנוס. All of you realize טומטום ואנדרוגנוס is not... Okay? It's somebody who has either both male and female... Right or neither. V'shar sheni habriyah mivi ma shematzah katuv b'sefer shut yad ne'eman shera'a le'achad kadosh mechachmei Yerushalayim shekatav kuntros sham shelo b'kutkat v'yav shematik u'misaper mikrim ke'ele shel hitapchut nikeva l'zachar v'gam masbir et inyan eich she'ein mutzim shum shinoi b'tochnat eivar ha'zachar yoter min hakeva ele shezur. And he goes in and he explains this and he says that Judaism will define somebody based upon what we see. So therefore, and after he writes all this, there'll be another tshuva, which you don't have in front of you, which I do have in front of me, which is in Chelek Yud Aleph Ayin Chet. A doctor will then say to him, I read what you wrote, what if I have, and again, he goes to a child that needs gender assignment, can I do the surgery, can I not do the surgery? But as I said, what does he say, which is really important? He says that a person is defined by what we see. Judaism does not go by chromosomes. He says, we don't look at XX or XY. He goes, based on what we see, based upon perception, and that's what the gender is. So based on this tshuva of Rav Waldenberg, who's talking about somebody who spontaneously changed from a woman to a man, and it happened because of later development, and therefore changes within the hormones, he therefore says, well, that person was... And it's also along the way, but the case that he discusses was somebody who was married. So what happens? Does he need a divorce from his husband? So, like, what do you do with this? So he quotes along the way, he quotes a Truman Hadeshin. Truman Hadeshin asked, did Eliyahu's wife need a get? Could she have remarried when Eliyahu went up into Shemayim? So he says, no, when a person becomes an angel, they're no longer alive. He went to, right? He went up to heaven. He's no longer alive. It doesn't make a difference. He's an angel, became an angel. So I've seen people in transsexual gender forums say, Rav Waldenberg believes transsexuals are all angels and that transsexual surgery is allowed. And I'm saying, I've read the tshuva and I've read the silliest things you can possibly imagine that people have taken out of this. And what they've done is they said, well, Rav Waldenberg allows transsexual surgery. He believes that you are whatever you look like on the outward, that's what you are. Now, it's true he said you are whatever you look like, but when did he say it? He says it in terms of the natural, whatever it is. He's not talking about based upon plastic surgery. And how do I know it's not based on plastic surgery? Because he doesn't allow plastic surgery. And by the way, believe it or not, I've never seen anybody discuss Rav Waldenberg's transsexual question and quote his position regarding cosmetic surgery. Not, why? Because they actually think that. He thinks that a person is now an angel, and so on. Because, again, I just don't know what to say, but if you want to amuse yourselves afterwards, you can go Googling around and look at how he's been quoted. Go back and read the entire tshuva. If you want, you can read the second tshuva as well. And, I told you you can get to the conclusion. The conclusion is, so is there going to be personal time in the 21st century? Of course there will. Why? Because nobody cares anymore. I'm sorry, I'm cynical. Nobody cares anymore. They're going to look for their halakhic answers on the internet, and whatever they find on the internet, that's going to be the real thing. Is anybody going to go back and read what Waldenberg actually said? Of course not. I can show you in Torah journals who've quoted this already in a completely, completely backward way from what he actually wrote. And as I said, I just challenge you to go back and look what he wrote and then compare it to how people quote him. Yeah. So what would he say to the guy who wants it? What would he say to him? He would say, Sheker Hachain Behebel Hayofi. I don't mean to be flippant. I understand. I'm just saying it happens to be. He doesn't think that that's a good enough reason. And you realize that he said that and he wrote that. So it's a little hard to believe. And by the way, I really, I don't mean to be flippant at all within this topic. And I understand that within the larger issue, there are important psychological and emotional issues that need to be dealt with, which I am purposely not dealing with. And all that I'm really trying to show is when we look at Poskim, following them through, and then we try to ask this question about personal autonomy, it's quite clear to me that in 20th century Poskim, it's not really an issue. It's not something which they're dealing with. When you look at the 21st century people quoting the 20th century, suddenly personal autonomy, which is very important to 21st century individuals, is going to be all over the place showing on how it's actually allowed. But the truth is that's going to be based upon, shall I call it, an inferior analysis, sometimes a lack of honesty in terms of citations, and creating whatever conclusions you choose to. Yes? I'm finished, by the way. You can ask what you think. Which that?
If it's true that in the 20th century there is no personal autonomy in Halakha.
I didn't say there's no. I just said it's not.
It's not in their vocabulary. Does that mean that it's not something that should be taken into consideration in Halakha thoughts nowadays?
I think you always have to take into consideration a person's emotional outlook. And therefore it becomes a natun, right? Is it the most important? Not necessarily. Which means I'm not going to change something 180 degrees because of personal autonomy. Will I take a person's own personal perspective in this? Again, 50 years ago, if I were a rabbi and somebody asked me a question, the odds are very strong they would listen to exactly what I say. Today, when somebody asks me a question, I know they're going to be Googling right afterwards and coming to hold, but this other rabbi said something else.
But if the halacha doesn't leave place to personal autonomy, then it doesn't matter what program I do.
Yeah, but I don't think it's the autonomy is the issue. That's exactly what I'm getting at. I think a rabbi has to take everything into consideration. The question is how much weight it gets. It's not that autonomy becomes the most important thing. And as much as I can tell, look, I'll tell you something interesting. Rav Shabtai, if anybody knows Rav Shabtai told me that in the early 20th century, almost all the poskim, in terms of their psak and labor law, were all socialists. They were all impacted by the trade unions. And there was a fight between a balabayit and between a poel. They always found a reason to rule in front of the poel because all what I would call or you would call meta-halachic considerations, because they just sort of felt that socialism was correct. They sort of felt that the workers had certain rights. They felt we need to protect the workers. Again, that's something which is fascinating. Is the posek always aware of it? I think that's really what's going to happen. Is that because personal autonomy becomes such an important issue, so the posek is going to be impacted by this as well, and he'll sort of just read it into it as something which is significant. But as I said, my reading of the 20th century is it just doesn't seem to be all that significant. Yes?
I know that Rabbi Eber seems to bring down this way, but in the shirt, but according to what we just seen in Tzitz Eliezer, if someone then did go ahead and anyway did it,
So that's what people are claiming. I don't believe that's what he's really saying. I don't think that he's saying that once you had it, now you are the other gender. Because he says you are what you look like, but he's saying you are what you look like in terms of what's outside and not what's inside. But he's not saying you are what you look like as a result of cosmetic surgery. Meaning he didn't take that last step. I'm just going to tell you a story to end. Nothing to do with personal autonomy. But I just want to thank whoever organized this. And whoever put all this together, because I think it's incredibly important. A, it's incredibly important that people get to learn. Two, it's incredibly important that the people get out and people get to do things and you have community activities. And here's the story. I studied in Rabbi Soloveitchik's chair for 3 years. During my last year there, he used to give a Parsha Shavua chair, but during my last year there, he stopped giving the chair because he wasn't feeling as well, and it ended. But here's how the Parsha Shavua chair began. Once upon a time, Rabbi Soloveitchik was in his apartment. His wife had passed away in 1967, so this is the late 70s. And he looks around the room and he says to the guys there, "Guys, what are you doing here?" And they say to him, "We're here to help you, Rebbe." He goes, "Why aren't you with your families?" He goes, "Because we're not married." He goes, "Why don't you get married?" So these are like the lifers from YU, the guys in their upper 20s and so on. And he goes, "Why don't you get married?" And one of them says, "Listen, it's not so easy to find girls. We're not the kind of guys who would go in shiduchim." This was YU in the late 70s. "And we're not the kind of guys who would hang out in front of Stern." This was YU in the late 70s. So Rabbi Soloveitchik thinks a second. He goes, "Okay, this is what we're going to do. Wednesday night, announce I'm giving a Parsha Shavua shir. It's open for everybody." And then he says, "I'll get the girls in the room, But you got to go over to them afterwards and talk to them. And that's why he started giving his Parsha Shavuot. Thank you.